to invite Otto to make his presentation and then take question and answers, and to be finished that bit by roughly 10 to 10 so that we can spend a few minutes talking about the merger issues and what's going to happen next week. And then, as always, a prompt finish for 10 o'clock so that people can get back to their business. So I'm delighted to welcome Otto Torreson. I could have made up my own biography of Otto, but I thought in the circumstances the safest thing to do was to take the official version. Otto has been chief executive of Aegon UK since April 2005. He was born and brought up in Buckey in northeast Scotland, graduated a first class honours degree in mathematics and statistics from Aberdeen University. He is, I am delighted to say, a fellow of the faculty, and spent 2 years studying management development at French Business School in INSEAD. He started with Scottish Equitable in 1978, and from 1988, he's held marketing roles at Abbey Life, Royal Insurance, and then Managing Director of Royal Life International. He returned to Scottish Equitable, which by then had been acquired by Aegon, in August 1994, becoming Finance Director of Aegon UK in 2000, and took the helm as Chief Executive in April 2005. In January of last year, his high-profile advocacy of greater levels for financial education to help people take responsibility for their personal finances led to an invitation from the Economic Secretary to the Treasury to chair an independent review of how an impartial system of generic financial advice might be made to work in practice, the Torreson Review of Generic Financial Advice. Otto is a board member of the Association of British Insurers and chairs its Life Insurance Committee. He is also a member of the Financial Services Advisory Board in Scotland, which is chaired by the First Minister and oversees the implementation of Scotland's financial services strategy. Obviously a very busy man. I'm delighted that he's found the time to be with us this morning. And Otto, I now invite you to speak to us about generic financial advice. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Stuart, follow that. I was impressed by that. I don't know about you. I didn't recognise much of it. Never mind. Good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here. This is very much the closing piece of a particular chapter in a long book about financial capability. As you'll see from this, as I get towards the end of this presentation, what's very clear is about what happens next, and whilst I'll have some involvement in what happens next, it'll be a very much less direct involvement than I've had over the last 14 months or so. So it's and this is the last presentation like this I'll make, so this is very much the close. So yeah, I might actually get a bit emotional from time to time, because this is, it's a peculiar experience I've just been through. So what I'm planning to do this morning is give you a bit of an understanding of what this whole review is about and what it attempts to do and what it's trying to change about the UK. Along the way, I suspect you'll pick up a little bit of how it feels to get involved in something like this. At the end, I'm very happy to take questions either on the content of what I talk about here in the Generic Advice Service, or about how these reviews work and how you interact with government and the extent to which there are pressures and challenges in that, because the insights that you get from being involved in one of these things are quite remarkable. I'll try to keep the time, Stuart. I do, particularly since it's my last one, I might go on a bit, so I'll take my watch off and try and focus a little bit on time. First, you know, why did I get involved in this in the first place? Well, I think probably I'd say two or three things. One, I've been involved in the long-term savings, the insurance business, as Stuart said, since 1978. I've always had a real belief that the business that we're in the life and pensions business in particular, has such potential in it to change outcomes for people and to create better futures for people, but so often tends to be characterised in the way it's talked about in the press in particular as an industry which is somewhat focused on creating good outcomes for others, perhaps financial intermediaries, for example, or shareholders. The emphasis on the customer tends never to come through to the extent that I think it can. And I'm sure part of that is because we are an industry which isn't completely understood. And I know that part of that is our own fault, because we make it very hard sometimes for people to understand what we do. Reputation is built on a number of things. Reputation is built, I think, substantially on people understanding what they can expect from you, and then you delivering on that. And so product performance, for example, and making it clear what a product can and can't do, making it clear to the customer who's bought that what it is they've got and what they can expect it to deliver to them, and then it delivering to them consistently, for me that gives you a far better chance of building a strong reputation. But any kind of communication like that between a transmitter and a receiver relies entirely on the two being tuned in together. And the receiver end is something in terms of the consumer's understanding of financial matters, which it's really hard to address. And that's where financial education, of course, comes in. But I believe what we're going to talk about this morning has the potential to have a big part to play in that too. But I think what really got me started on this was, funnily enough, a trip that I made to Washington. It was about 6 months after I had taken over as CEO at Aegon here in Edinburgh. And one of our guys, who some of you may know, his name's Laurie Edmonds, he's very well known in the industry. Laurie was working with us at that time on a number of things, but he was very focused on financial capability, but he was also focused on pensions and pension reform. And our lobbying activity and our engagement activity in that area. And one of the things Laurie got invited to was a conference on global aging in Washington. And it was that was the AARP in the States and various bodies here in the UK coming together to talk about all the issues that aging was creating, all the challenges that aging was creating in society and for the industry. And it was about the time that the Turner Commission was working towards its final report. It was a particularly interesting time to be in that kind of forum. Now, Laurie, one of his daughters was graduating on the day that he had to go to Washington. And Laurie clearly had his priorities right. He wanted to go and see his daughter graduate. But he couldn't delegate this up. He couldn't delegate this downwards or sideways, this invitation. He could only delegate it upwards. So he got me to go. And I went along to this, not really knowing what to expect. It was 3 or 4 days just on the subject of aging. It was mainly academics and people in government, DWP representatives, those sorts of people. Very few commercial people, lots of third sector people. It was the most fascinating experience, because for a commercial CEO to be given the opportunity to basically spend 3 days out just listening to the discussion and the debate about this enormous issue for society. And the penny dropped with me in a number of ways. One of the ways that the penny dropped with me was that aging is not just about how you get your pricing right on annuities. Aging is actually how do you run a company with 4,500 staff when the people in that organisation are going to have to think about working potentially much longer than they would have done a generation or two ago. How does your whole career development programme work in an environment where the old model, which was try and be as senior a position as you can when you retire, because your final salary scheme will kick in at that point and that will give you the most certain level of retirement income. Instead, you'll be potentially peaking in your 40s and then having to find alternative ways to work within the organisation into your 50s, your 60s, maybe even your 70s. And how ready are organisations for that sort of challenge when they think about their structures and their remuneration approaches and everything? But of course, the issue of pensions was at the centre of what was being talked about. And the issue that came out for me there was whether they knew it or not, a very large proportion of the population of the UK are going to be placed in a position where they are completely reliant on their own wits to determine what kind of lifestyle they're going to have in those extended 30 or 40 years of retirement they're facing. And what are we going to do about that? How are we going to deal with that? And that was what got me sucked into this whole area of financial capability. And as Stuart says, I was invited in January last year to lead this independent review. Now, at that point, I must admit, I did think twice about saying yes. I'm an active CEO, for a start. I could hear all the questions and all the challenges about what, you know, who's running the shop and how do you balance your time and all the rest of that. But at the same time, you know, you do sometimes, if you really believe in something like this and you believe you have the opportunity perhaps to put the industry back at a place where it's being accepted as part of the answer again, it would be completely wrong not to take that. Now, from my own personal experience, before I actually get onto my presentation, which I'm sure you're all desperate to see, the personal development experience I've had over the last 14 months has been remarkable. I mean, I've never, you know, you think when you get over 50, you know, some of that learning begins to slow down. One's opportunity to get involved with the sharpest brains and some of the best debaters and people at arguing their case has been amazing. The chance to get involved in seeing what's going on in the third sector, Citizens Advice Bureau, organisations like that, to get closer to what's going on in crisis management services that are being delivered across the country already, to see how people see our industry from the outside in a totally objective way, has been remarkable. And the other great benefit, you know, one of the things about being in a big company is that the more senior you get in that big company, the less you are reliant on your own wits, on your own ability, your own personal response in a particular situation. Increasingly, you take the credit for work that other people do. In a situation like this, where you're back to a small team, half a dozen people, you are on the front line in every engagement, every speaking situation, every group that you go and talk to, every steering group you have to present in front of, every minister that you see, it's back to you again. And initially that was terrifying, I've got to say. The first few months it was just incredible. But what you discover in yourself, of course, is that there is something there and it comes back out again and you start developing it again. So from that point of view, as a personal development experience, it's been remarkable, giving me hopefully some insight that I can now take back to the way we look at our business and the way we look at our customers and the way we look at developing our services. So that very brief introduction, let's go on. What was the review about first? Well, I think the important thing is it is absolutely in the financial capability space. It's about how can you deal with issues on the demand side. It's about how can you help people understand more about basic, simple financial matters, get the guidance they need to make the decisions they have to take every day of the week, every week of the year. We came up with 10 recommendations. We made that, and I'm going to go through these basically in order and talk around them a little bit and how they all fit together. The principles that the service should be delivered against, the scope of the service, the model through which it should be delivered, the approach in a multi-channel way, talk about branding, talk about marketing strategy, and talk about how we saw the project being taken forward from here. I think the important thing is also to note that what I was asked to do was to deliver a blueprint for how a service like this could be delivered, not if a service like this should be delivered. The argument from government was that the case was made for this, and that what we had to do was identify how it should be done most effectively. It's fair to say that if I look back over the 14 months, I reckon I spent something like 50% of the time arguing for the if and the whether this should be done rather than the how. And I think that's, you know, I'm not ashamed of that, and nor do I think anyone with whom I was arguing should be ashamed, because essentially what this is about is, you know, is it possible to engage with people about something that isn't a problem now so that they can take action before it becomes a problem? This is what an awful lot of the stuff that we talk about in this review is all around. And the other question which you need to be able to answer is, if people do engage with you, and if you can get in touch with them, and if they will listen to what you say, and if the guidance is relevant to them, will they actually take any action as a result of that, or will they simply go back to what they were doing before, having got something off their chest and feeling that they've kind of got some therapy from that experience, but actually they don't do anything? And if they don't do anything, what have you achieved, actually? You haven't achieved very much at all. And to a certain extent, I think it's fair to say, after 14 months, those questions are still out there. We didn't answer those questions categorically. We did some things which I think gave us some reason to believe that both could be answered in the right way, but there's still work to be done there. So, let's move on. First, the governing principles. This came out from discussions with people quite early in the process. We did a lot of information gathering. We ran a call for evidence at the very beginning of the process through February, March, April. We talked to any number of organisations who were already involved in these areas. We got 100 responses to our call for evidence. We went out and visited sites. We ran consumer workshops. We talked to people already active in similar areas. And what came through very strongly was that there were five pieces that needed to be present for this to be effective and successful. Firstly, people, the users of the service, needed to know that it was on their side, that there was no angle in this, that there wasn't a government attempt to persuade them to do things that suited the government, nor was it an industry attempt to sell them things. This was a service which actually helped them make their own decisions about what they should do next. A supportive service too, so not one that criticised people or pointed the finger at them or wagged the finger at them, but actually something that people could work with to gain more confidence in dealing with money matters. Very importantly, a preventative service. This is not a crisis management service or a debt management service for people who are already in crisis. This is about getting to people when they've still got options and when they can still take actions which will lead to better futures for them, getting them in control of their financial affairs, engaging with the various providers of service with whom they work on a far more equal footing. And the outcome from that should be more empowered consumers and more engaged consumers and fewer finding themselves in crisis where their options are far more limited and where the outcomes are far more unattractive to them. A lot of discussion about who this was really for in terms of the target group. My terms of reference talked about those most vulnerable to lack of financial capability and bad financial decisions. In a way, I spent most of the year trying to recover from that positioning, because that tended to put it in people's minds as this is a service for the poor. Whereas in fact, what we proved through all the work we did is that everybody, pretty well everybody in the UK at one or other time in their lives will find themselves in a situation where life events create an environment in which, no matter how capable they are at the beginning, the pressure and the stress that's created through that event, that life event, make them less able to cope and less able to engage well in dealing with the issues that situation creates for them. So our view is this is a service which everybody should be able to access and should be positioned as a service that's there for all. And finally, the sales-free piece. The impartiality issue is key here. And we discovered through the work we did that if people feel that there's a selling story at the back of what's being done with them, they begin to step back and distrust what's being given to them in terms of guidance. So the whole principle behind the service that we've sought to deliver here is one that is impartial and one that is not delivered in a selling environment. Now, we make the point that that doesn't mean that commercial organisations can't deliver the service. It's just that if they are going to do it with the money guidance stamp on it, then they have to be able to show that they can do that in that impartial and sales-free way. And the customer needs to know that that's the basis on which it's being done. Look at scope. Well, I've kind of covered this already, but it's worth reinforcing it. This is really about the basics. And I think another of the distractions for us as we ran this review was that the FSA's retail distribution review was running very much about the same time. And in, and the retail distribution review from the FSA is all about sales regulation and regulating the delivery of product to clients. This is about financial capability, and they are very different. And I think the focus of our service is very much at the basics. It's about budgeting. It's about helping people think about their savings and think about their debt more sensibly. It's about, do they have the kind of protection in place, whether that's protection for individuals and people or whether that's protection for their goods and their houses and their motor cars. Do they think about the long term? Increasingly, this thing is going to have to help people think about where their income in retirement is going to come from. You know, when you stop working and you're not earning, what are you going to do and what kind of life do you want to lead? The tax system and the welfare system in the UK is as complex as anywhere. Interpreting what's going on in that, helping people find their way through to where the benefit system makes sense for them, helping them understand the tax position better, is part of what this service needs to do. And then finally, jargon busting, interpreting the technical language of the industry, encouraging people when they get a letter from a financial services organisation to seek to understand what's in it, rather than sticking it in the bottom drawer and just hoping it'll go away, which I think is the reaction that many people have currently to the material that we send them. So about the basics, and I think it's important to remember that. This is not about selling products to people. But we do believe that by helping people, if you like, on this staircase to better financial capability, more people will engage with the industry. And once they have engaged with the industry, more people will stay. So the persistency benefit from a service like this being effective, we think could be quite substantial. Again, from very early on, it was clear that the most effective way of delivering something like this was in partnership with people who were already active in various areas. So, for example, Citizens Advice Bureau, which is a very good example, or the Pensions Advisory Service, which is another very good example. Existing organisations who deliver guidance to people, the Citizens Advice Bureau on a number of different things, but financial matters being quite an important part of what they do. So the idea very much is to try and deliver a guidance service like this, working with existing service providers. And the concept that we've put forward is one where there is a central body which sets the strategy for the service, which controls the marketing of the service, which looks at the content and the quality of the advice and the guidance that's given to people, that deals with accreditation so that the quality is actually there in terms of the experience that people have, and also controls the funding of the service. But when you look at how the service is delivered, who is it that people would talk to? Who is it that people would phone up? Well, they might phone up a central telephone unit, but actually in practice, probably what they would do is go to the Citizens Advice Bureau if that's where they're comfortable, or any other organisation which manages to become an accredited partner of the service. And I think the other thing that this slide is quite important in is that this isn't regulated advice. This is not FSA regulated advice. This is about help and guidance to people. So there's nothing illegal about somebody else deciding that they can set up a service like this if they want to. I mean, people do it already. If you go on the internet and do a Google search, you'll find a number of organisations which get into this territory. Some commercial organisations already deliver services like this. There's nothing to stop people going on doing that. What we're saying here is that if you want to be part of this umbrella organisation, which is trying to drive this forward in a far more proactive way, and if you want to be part of the delivery of this service under that umbrella, there are standards which you have to meet, there are certain ways that you have to do this to have that badge, that accredited badge, on the service that you deliver. And clearly, the concept is that over time, more and more and more of these sorts of services would come under that umbrella, and there would be that joined up approach to the delivery of this service across the UK. Multi-channel is a bit of a no-brainer, to be honest. I think the problem with looking at internet and web-based services currently is that whilst this is a universal service that everyone can access, an awful lot of people don't actually feel as comfortable using the web as you might think for something like this. And I think the challenge with the web is that almost what you have to do here with an issue like this, is if you're a user of the service, if you're somebody who's got say they've just got a letter in from, you know, Aegon or from Scottish Widows or whoever it is, or from the bank, and in it's a whole load of stuff. Actually, talking somebody through that is what you have to do. It's very hard for somebody to initiate that process themselves. You know, it's very hard to know where to start apart from anything else. And it's very hard for even a quite an interactive web facility to help people through, because the first thing you have to do with somebody in these situations, and I spent a lot of my time last year listening to calls being handled by particularly the crisis management services, is to unpack the problem. You know, what's the real problem? Because the user will phone up with an issue that's in their mind, but actually they won't themselves know what the real problem is. You have to help them find what the real problem is and then help them find what the solution is. So I think it could be some time before the web is quite as effective as we'd like it to be. And I think two things have to happen there. I think more generations have to come through who are far more internet savvy. And I think the other thing is that the way the technology works and where the technology is accessed has to change a little. So it needs to stop being the thing that largely is what you do in the utility room or up in the attic bedroom or wherever it is you keep yours. It's something that you do sitting in front of the 42-inch digital TV, and it's as easy as clicking a few buttons and you're right in there. Now, that's not that far away, I don't think. But in the here and now, you know, I think we have to be realistic about the extent to which the internet can be the answer to all our problems. So the telephone, I think, will be a big part of it. And the face-to-face delivery continues to be important for a lot of people. An awful lot of people still want to be able to sit down with somebody and just talk to them about the issue that they're trying to deal with. Branding, we don't say much about branding. You know, in 14 months you can only do so much. What we did say was that it was important that the positioning of this reinforced the two really strong elements of the service, the principles of the service, and that's the on my side piece, the on the user side dimension, and the sales free dimension. We've picked a number of examples there from related services. We've got about a 100-page report, I think, from the National Social Marketing Group on, you know, how marketing works in this sort of environment. I won't say much more about it here, but we said it was important that a brand for money guidance should be established to make sure that people understood that this service was new and was different and was very much on their side. Probably worth saying, you know, I talk about money guidance. The terms of reference talked about generic financial advice. It was clear right at the beginning that generic financial advice didn't mean anything to anybody, really, not even people in the industry, to be honest, other than those who had been involved in the subject for many years. What I did know was that generic financial advice brought an awful lot, or added to the confusion that there was with regulated financial advice. And with these things, you know, one of the things you have to do is to deal with the potential ghosts that there are wandering around the brief that you've been given. And one of the rumours was that this was a government-sponsored IFA that people could access free, and it was the way the Treasury were going to try and get the IFA sector. Now, it was never even remotely in the remit that was what this was. But the trouble is, if you're trying to get your message over, and if you're trying to get people to spend their time discussing with you the things that are real as opposed to the things that aren't, you have to deal with these things. And the use of language is an important way of dealing with these things. I knew that when we published the report, if all that people were talking about was, well, but how does this fit with regulated financial advice, and isn't this just, you know, already what the IFA sector's doing, the whole debate about would this work and should this be done and should this be taken forward would be lost. So you just have to realise there are some things you have to deal with. Apart from that, as I say, nobody understood what generic financial advice was, and if we were going to get some press coverage at the launch time of the review, I wanted people to be talking about what the service was and understanding what the service was. Because one other thing you realise when you get involved in one of these things is that in all probability, when you publish, that's just the beginning. Because once you publish the review, your challenge then is to get something done with it and not have it end up on a shelf somewhere and just gather dust. So we were very focused on how we were going to take that message out to try and achieve something substantial at the end of 14 months' hard work. Engaging the consumer with the service is, as I hinted earlier when I was talking about the sceptics and those who didn't believe that a service like this was even needed or would be used, this is probably the biggest challenge, because you want people to talk to you before they get into crisis. You want people to start thinking about these issues when they're still in a position to do something about it. Now, there's a load of stuff in the report about how we think this can work. Yes, there will need to be some national advertising. Yes, you've got to raise awareness of the fact that the thing exists and what it can do. But we do believe the most effective techniques will be tied around the life events that I've talked about earlier. That the key here will be when people are facing changes in their lives for whatever reason, there's the opportunity, through probably somebody that they're already talking to as part of that other thing, to understand that there's a service here which you can use which will help you sort out what their financial challenges are and how you can deal with them. So examples from the FSA's work, lots of stuff in the worksite, but also things like stuff they're doing with midwives for people who are having their first or second child. You know, at the point when you discover that there's a child coming and you realise that you're going to lose for a period one of the income generators in the family, naturally your thoughts turn to how are we going to cope financially with this. And there's a lot of stress associated with that, of course. If you can intercede at that point and give people help to think through how they're going to deal with the consequences, apart from anything else, they then can relax more and think more about what should be a very positive experience for them and something that they should really be happy about rather than worrying about. And there are a number more examples of that. I think the other nice thing about the trusted intermediaries route is that if you look at how this dovetails in with financial education, I mean, another of the big challenges that we've faced consistently is, shouldn't the money that you're talking about spending on this be spent on improving financial education? Well, financial education is a key plank in improving financial capability. But for a lot of people, we've missed that bus, you know, that one's left. So for those who haven't got the benefit or the opportunity from financial education, where can they go? Well, they can go to the service that will be built here. Another perspective on that is that coming out of the school system with improved levels of financial education achieves next to nothing if that then decays to a point where 10 years later, because the world's moved on and because they've not been keeping it fresh in their minds, they're right back where they started from. The concept here is to engage with people as they go into the workplace, which is one of the biggest life changes that we all experience, and keep it fresh, keep engaged with them, keep them thinking about where that financial stuff fits in all the other things they have to think about as they begin to manage their lives. We had to have somebody to whom we passed the baton here in terms of keeping this moving. We did a lot of work on where this service could be governed from and who could own it. And the FSA came out best from that work for a number of reasons. They've been working in the area of financial capability for many years. Some of the examples I've been giving you this morning are FSA experience, stuff they've actually done and proven they can make work. They have a very well developed website which helps with financial capability communication to people. They've worked in partnership with organisations in the UK for many years in delivering these services. They work with organisations in financial education too. Actually, they have an ability to levy money from the industry, and given that my whole basis from the start on this project was that this would be a jointly funded venture between the industry and government, clearly the practical matter of raising the money was quite an important one for us to address. And the other good news was that they were keen to take it forward. As I talked to people in this sector, one of the things they said is, please don't create another body, yet another body, that's going to take this forward independent of all the other things that are going on. And please try to find a way to join these things together better so that we don't have initiative-itis, which of course characterises a lot of the work which goes on in these areas. So our recommendation was that the FSA should do that. As I said a few minutes ago, funding was always a challenging part of the review. Our going in position was that there were benefits for the industry from this and there were benefits for government from this, and therefore there should be a split in the investment to make it happen between government and the industry. We recommended that. We didn't hear anything that put us off that. It would be wrong to say that the industry were unanimous in their enthusiasm for taking on another cost. As a CEO of a life company, I can't say that I'm enthusiastic about the prospect of taking on another cost. But I see it as an investment. I still believe in it as an investment. And I think, again, if I characterise the industry, I think there are three camps. There are some who, like me, who are quite passionate about financial capability and the importance of developing it further and taking it on and trying these things and getting a consumer base out there who are more enthusiastic about what we do and more engaged with what we do. And we are strong supporters. There's a middle group who are far less convinced about that, but believe, if you like, for corporate social responsibility reasons, that this is a sensible thing to do and the cost actually isn't that excessive, so fair enough, we'll go along with it. Then there's the other group who just don't believe it'll work. They just don't believe people will come to use the service, and they don't believe that even when they do use the service that anything will change as a result of that. And whilst I think we made some progress with the middle group and made them slightly more enthusiastic, and perhaps we made the third group a little bit less sceptical, I'm not going to pretend that there aren't still sceptics out there, and our recommendations, I think, have taken that into account. On the actual costs, we identified that our estimates of around about 50 million operating cost for this service a year to service around 4 million users, we felt those were reasonable. The costs actually still assume that a lot of the interaction will be through the internet, despite the fact, as I said earlier, that I have doubts still about how it can be totally effective for everybody. It is still an effective way of engaging with people where those people are familiar and comfortable with using that technology. So, where did we get to at the end? Well, for a variety of reasons, partly because through the experience of running the review, we ran a couple of prototypes at the back end of last year, which actually sought to deliver a service like this on a very small scale, on a very localized basis. The whole point of the prototypes was to see what people felt when they used the service, to put something together that people could try out and then tell us what they thought about it. And we learned a lot from that, but they weren't statistically significant in terms of their analysis, and it was clear that they weren't going to convince anybody on their own that investing for the industry another £25 million every year in something like this would make sense. So partly because we needed to test our hypothesis more robustly, partly because we needed to fine-tune the model that we'd developed and the engagement strategies that we thought could work, partly because we felt to justify the level of investment that we were talking about, we needed far more robust data on which to do that. Our proposal was to take the thing forward over the next 18 months or so in what's become accepted in government speak as a Pathfinder project. Now, a Pathfinder project is effectively the first step towards a national rollout of something. So it's not another pilot and it's not another test. It's actually the first step towards a national rollout. By the time that service, Pathfinder, has been delivered, we expect up to 750,000 people to have tried this out. So we'll have far more data on what people do and what people don't do, on what actions they take, on whether the assumptions that went into our benefit forecasts in our cost-benefit analysis are reasonable, and whether the whole financial justification for this thing is likely to be held up or not. I'm pretty confident, actually, that those Pathfinder projects will deliver very strong evidence that this thing can be made to work, but, you know, we'll wait and see. Essentially, through the Pathfinder, well, we're gonna put all the pieces that we've designed, at least in some level of detail, right through to where you need to get them to do this thing for real. And all these areas are areas that the Pathfinder will have to address. And also, in practice, we'll learn, as I say, from the experience whether the idea actually has the potential to work in practice. £12 million split across the development phase and the delivery phase. Quite a significant amount of money being invested in marketing, but because it's the first stage towards national rollout, that money wouldn't be wasted. It would be getting us to a point where we had a launch pad, if you like, to take the thing far more broadly. And a large amount of time spent on evaluating the success of the various elements of the partnership model and the practicality of moving people through it in a way that the customer feels they're getting a good experience. So we launched it on the 3rd of March, and of course the surprise, it wasn't entirely a surprise to me because they'd given me a couple of days warning of the fact that they were going to support it. The government actually announced that they were going to support the Pathfinder and put the half of the money up to make it happen. A fantastic outcome for us who'd worked on the review for 14 months, because our objective had always been to create something that could be done, something that was practical, something that would get support, something that would get broad consensus from around the industry and from around the other parts of the UK who are involved in this stuff. To get the support from the government on the day just made a huge difference to everybody. It made a big difference to me because it means that I'm not going to spend the next 6 months, as I've just said earlier when I opened this thing, going around trying to persuade people to support this. That's done. Somebody else will take that work forward now. But from the more important point of view, something will actually happen here, and I believe this service will exist in 2 years' time, and that's a fantastic outcome. And I think a fantastic outcome for the industry, although I think, as I say, there are still some parts of the industry who are less convinced about that than I am. A recommendation that the FSA should lead it was accepted, and the great thing about that was that the sponsor in the FSA is a guy called Chris Pond, who maybe one or two of you know. Chris was a member of what they described as my reference group. So right from the beginning of the project in January last year, Chris was an advisor to what we were doing. He was involved in what we were doing. He has been a great and energetic supporter of the work we've been doing. And so you're handing this on to somebody who really cares about the outcome, who understands the work that you've done in getting to where you've got to, and actually takes it forward pretty well, seamlessly. There's a chap on there, in the second bullet from the bottom, Ted Hart. Ted had come from the FSA to work with me on the review over the last 14 months. He was my project leader in the Treasury for the 14 months. He's now gone back to the FSA, and he's working for Chris Pond to take the work forward from here. So, in many ways, from a neat and tidy point of view, you know, I couldn't have asked for better. I got the funding on the day we announced the review. I got the team in place who had been working largely on the project for the last 14 months to take it forward. From a personal point of view, what I'll do, they've asked me to join the steering group of the financial capability work that goes on within the FSA. So this is part of their financial capability agenda. I'll sit on the steering group now and observe and help and support the work from here. It is a good outcome. There are many challenges still in making this work, though. I'm sure you've got some you might want to ask me about. But one I'll put forward is, it's one thing to talk to people in an environment like this where almost everybody actually is motivated by a desire to change outcomes for people and get to a point where you can get broad consensus against, a template for how the thing could be made to work. To make that work in reality, to actually get all those organisations to work together and cooperate together to deliver something on the basis we've described, is an enormous challenge. Because when you get down to the nitty-gritty of trying to make it work, that's where, whilst people were able to come with you so far on a consensual basis, all the specifics of what they believe to be the best way to deal with X or Y or Z start to come to the surface. And it's going to take a really firm hand to push this through on a workable and effective basis. But I think we've got to a point where we've got a lot of following wind and a lot of opportunity for it to happen. As I say, from my point of view, getting involved in this was something I did because I thought it was really important that we saw a good outcome here and that financial capability in the UK was raised. I think we've got to a point now where an important ingredient in that potentially will actually be delivered. I'm obviously very pleased about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Otto. We have a few minutes for questions or comments from the floor. Yes, Harry.
My name is Harry Taylor. Also, I'm sure that the people in the room want to give you congratulate you and the team for producing this kind of very practical approach, which should make a real difference in the UK, and the facts and actuary that's leading it should help with improving the overall image of actuaries. I guess I've got one question, and it's thinking of end-to-end delivery of high-quality financial services, and that is, this addresses a huge gap that is at the front end, but the next step on from this is delivering high-quality services. That requires real embedding of treating customers fairly principles, and also requires a satisfactory outcome from retail distribution review. I just wondered what thoughts you had on the next stage on from this, because I believe this will be successful.
Well, thanks for that.
It's not over, that's for sure. I was involved in the early stages of the retail distribution review as well. I ran a work stream in there on consumer access at the same time as I was starting this up. I think the RDR has still got a long way to go, I think is probably the way I would describe it. I think the problem with the RDR at the moment is it's trying to deal with about four or five different issues all at once. And I think, frankly, that's a hell of a challenge. And I think you end up potentially compromising on all of them and ending up with nothing very much. I mean, that's a slightly overstatement, sorry, but, and I don't mean it quite as black and white as that. So now that I'm free of this, I mean, my ability to get engaged much in that work when I was working effectively under Treasury sponsorship was less. I certainly plan to re-engage now. And I think what we have to do in the industry is map out what we would like the total outcome to be, and map out the stages and the elements that we need to step forward on to get there. And they need to be steps that aren't gonna rely on each other. So there are some things we can do. I mean, one of the issues, for example, which I think is really important, is for the industry to stop measuring its success in terms of its share of new business. Because we all know in the life and pension sector what that means and what it doesn't mean. And we have to move away from that. We have to move to a place where we're being far more honest about where value is being created. Because CEOs like me are driven by what's measured, I'm afraid, because ultimately that's what keeps us in a job, is how well we perform against the targets that people think are important. There are so many things like that, Harry, that have to be looked at. I think TCF is starting to make some more sense too. But the industry's got to respond positively now, and with some energy and a bit of courage, because there is an opportunity, I think, right now for this to start to come together into a far more positive world for the industry and for the consumer.
Next question or comment, please.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, my name is Michael Sharp. Thank you very much, Arthur, for all you've done in preparing and delivering the review and for speaking today. Thank you. In the year 2012, a new state pension scheme is envisaged, which will involve probably 10 million people having to make a decision to opt into a scheme or to opt out of a scheme. Do you think there's enough being done now to get everything in place to give those people the help they're going to need?
That's a dead-on question, that one. When I started out on this thing, there were two icebergs that I thought I could end up hitting that could do me do the review real damage. One was the whole issue of funding, which I knew was going to be a challenge all the way through. The other was pension reform. In the first couple of months that we ran with the review, our review was mentioned more times than I've had hot dinners as the answer to dealing with every question. Not just in pension reform, has to be said, but world peace was in there too, but pension reform certainly was in there. Then it calmed down, and I think we got it to a sensible place. What we say we can do, we can give people guidance on retirement issues. We can help people understand the questions they need to ask themselves. We can help people interpret some of the stuff they're given, whether it's from their employer or from, you know, the DWP or whatever. But we can't take the decision for them. Individuals still have to take those decisions for themselves. TPAS working with us in partnership can give them more guidance, but they still can't take the decision for them. And the first time I realised how political this can get was actually, it was a couple of weeks ago, I was doing a piece with one of the parliamentary groups post-publication, and for the first time I found myself being quizzed by representatives of the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats with a view to how they could use the answers that I gave to beat the pensions minister up on the pensions bill. And you could smell the difference. It was a complete from consensual debate and discussion to hard-nosed politics. The simple answer to your question is I don't think there is enough being done yet. I think the DWP have a communication strategy which I'm sure they will launch with a lot of goodwill and a good attempt to try and have a good outcome for people. But it's going to be difficult for people to understand what it's telling them. And there are going to be limits to what this service can do for people. It can do a lot, but there are still limits. And there's still going to be that really difficult issue around means testing, which I think hasn't gone away yet. And I suspect over the next few months we'll see that issue develop.
Okay, one final question or comment. Ronnie Stone.
My name's Ronnie Stone, can you hear me?
We certainly can.
Thank you. Ronnie Sloan, yes, is my name. I've been an advisor to individuals for many years. I was a compliance officer and all the rest of it. So I've had a lot of frontline experience of the kind of things you're talking about. And I don't doubt that you've done a very good job in your report. What saddens me is the fact that so much advice of this kind is needed. You referred rightly to people possibly peaking in their 40s and so on. So career average revalued pensions seem like a good idea. We had that in the state scheme since 1978, called SERPs. It's been progressively dismantled. That's unfortunate. I think in the personal accounts, we need an attractive index-linked default option for people who don't take the advice that you're offering. Something that's sensible and is genuinely indexed and gives some real value for money. Again, we used to have a thing like that. It was called with profits. Unfortunately, that's rather been fallen by the wayside. So the need for this is all rather unfortunate, I feel, but nonetheless is needed. So coming to my question, you say it's sales free. Fair enough, but I find it difficult to square this with the fact that you're going to need to persuade people to join personal accounts when you've got a high hurdle of an employee contribution of 5% with an employer contribution of 3%. I mean, to use a technical expression, it's plain daft. No private sector scheme would ever operate on such a basis. So I'm not sure that isn't a high hurdle in terms of having to sell the concept. I mean, obviously they should join it, but it's not really a very attractive package.
And there are two different discussions woven in together there, I think, and I know that we're getting short on time, so I'll give the short answer. We had always to try and make sure we stayed within our scope, because if we allowed our scope to creep out into other areas, we were never going to achieve anything in any kind of time frame. So we focused on the job that we were asked to do, which was about a blueprint for a service like the one we've described. The issues you're talking about, Ronnie, in terms of the challenges people face, the attractiveness of solutions, the difficulty in getting people to commit and defer gratification, if you like, for the benefit in the long term, all those issues absolutely remain. And all that we can do through our service, I think, is to help people begin to recognise that there are downsides to doing nothing, as well as, you know, challenges in doing something. But there's got to be something else as well, and that means that whether it's the financial services industry or whether it's the employer base or whether it's government, proper decisions have to be taken to try and close this gap from the other end as well as from the financial capability end.
Okay, I think we've got to close it there, but I'd like you all to join me in thanking Otto for his excellent presentation in the normal way. Thank you very much. Now, I think those clocks on the wall are 2 minutes fast, probably deliberately. So I think I've got 2 minutes. 2 minutes. First of all, next week, a week today, in this lecture theatre here, 4:30 for 5 is the consultation meeting, which is informal. Then at 6:30, only for fellows of the faculty, is the requisitioned special general meeting.
where the four resolutions will be discussed and voted on. So please do come. This is democracy in action. Please come. Show your opinion. I am planning at the end of the consultation meeting to take a show of hands to try and gauge the mood of those who attend the consultation meeting. Then, of course, in the requisition special general meeting, we will be having formal voting. I'll be adopting an advocacy role in the first meeting, the consultation meeting. I will not be adopting an advocacy role in the special general meeting because I will be chairing that as president of the faculty, and it would be not appropriate for me, I think, to adopt an advocacy role in the formal meeting. I won't repeat to you what I'm going to say in the consultation meeting, but I do just want to just tell you three very brief anecdotes under the heading of "To See Ourselves as Others See Us." Some years ago, I had a dinner with a leader of the accountancy profession, and we got to discussing structure. And I happened to mention that some years ago, we had merged our examination structure so that a fellow qualifying as a fellow of the faculty had passed exactly the same examinations as someone qualifying as a fellow of the institute. His immediate comment was, "Well then, it is only a matter of time until you merge, because you have lost the rationale for a separate professional identity." That was the leader of the accountancy profession. Another anecdote: in February this year, I went to India to represent the faculty at the Institute of Actuaries of India. And afterwards, the Honorary Secretary came up to me for a chat, an Indian chap, not surprisingly. And when he started speaking to me, he spoke with a West of Scotland accent. It turned out he was a fellow of the faculty. And his comment to me was totally unprompted: "Why don't you just get on and do it? Why didn't you do it years ago?" That was an FFA who was the Honorary Secretary of the Indian profession. Third one was when I attended at the start of last month. I attended, representing the actual profession again, a seminar of mortality experts at Stapledean. You can just imagine people parading in, carrying their sickles and wearing their hooded cloaks. But it was it wasn't quite like that. But over coffee beforehand, I got talking to one of the professors who's an expert in this field who I hadn't met before. I introduced myself, said, "I'm Stuart Ritchie, I'm president of the Faculty of Actuaries," and he said, "Which university is that?" That is as others see us. Those are just three brief anecdotes in advance of next week's meeting. It has now gone 2 minutes past 10. I've broken my promise to free you at 10 o'clock, but I now free you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.